Welcome, everybody, to the Q&A session for February from the Ziegler School in beautiful Bel Air. So the Q's are yours, and hopefully I'll have a couple A's.
The last time we had Q&A as a community was the day after the presidential election, and your responses, as I recall, were very optimistic and looking towards the future and giving Kaftan's quote to our newly elected president. What are your thoughts 3 months later, 4 months later?
So want to make sure everybody heard. The question was that the last Q&A we had was the day after the presidential election, and I urged people to give the president-elect a chance to start to govern and to not condemn the person as a person, but to focus on what his proposals and appointments were. So however many more months now later, I think my opinion has not changed, but the circumstances have changed. In other words, I think it's an American's right and duty to protest policies that they think are harmful to the Republic and to resist appointments that they think are harmful to the Republic. So I still am of a mind that I don't think it helps a credible resistance to criticize the person who's in the position, but I think we have an obligation to be critical of policies that we think are harmful or which we think violate core Jewish values. And the peaceful and civil protest of those policies and attempting to move the democratic system to safeguard people's rights and freedoms, I think, is the duty of every citizen. So I still think ad hominem attacks are not very effective in general, and I think we should focus on identifying those of you who don't agree with the administration's policies, which policies can best be slowed down or reversed, and how you can best impact the political system to shape elections in the future. It is ultimately a system of checks and balances, and I think we need to think about how to utilize the system. It should come as no surprise. I'm going to try to avoid personal partisan comments, but it should come as no surprise. The conservative movement came together as a movement. All of the major arms of the movement came out criticizing the president's executive order preventing refugees from entering this country and any Muslim ban that's being bandied around, because we see that as a profound violation not only of core Torah values, but also of the repeated lessons of Jewish history and what it means to be an outcast from not one but multiple societies, and the fact that all of us come from people who were immigrants and in some cases refugees. So I think I was proud of us for signing on. I was proud of conservative Masorti movement for taking that stand. And I think that's exactly where we need to be as the Jewish people, which is monitoring policy suggestions and proposed appointments and making sure that they conform to the highest Jewish values. Others.
This question comes from Emily Goldsman. She's wondering if a minor, someone under the age of 12 or 13, I guess, converts to Judaism, do they need to go before a Beit Din?
Does someone need to go before a Beit Din if they convert to Judaism before, I assume, bar mitzvah age or before legal majority age? Only if they're a person. Like, why would age have anything to do with whether they go before a Beit Din or not? So, no, I'm being told no. They don't have to go before a Beit Din, because the parents have legal guardianship over them? Speak, Rabbi.
So everybody needs a mikvah. It depends on the age. So if the child is, let's say, close to bar mitzvah age, then generally what happens is one of the rabbis will say, do you understand what you're about to do? Are you in agreement with this process? And we'll chat for a little while. But we generally, the rabbinical assembly, I'm not speaking for the rabbinical assembly, but let's say those conversions with which I have been involved for people under the age of bar mitzvah, if the child is old enough, we do check to make sure the child has some understanding of what they're taking on. But we generally don't do a formal Beit Din.
Great. Okay. That was Rabbi Pat Fenton, a great scholar of Jewish law and Torah. I'm happy that she was here. I have been out of the retail end of the business for a while. So there you have it. So maybe not a formal Beit Din, but certainly to ascertain that the child knows what they're getting themselves into and is able to do it knowingly. And you had a question?
Since I didn't hear the start of the first, this might be too similar, so I think I might know where you go with this, but I've been reading about whether Jewish organizations should normalize relations with the Trump administration at all.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, look, I'm trying to decide what I think and what I want to say publicly. Those aren't exactly the same thing. So let's try this with me thinking of the broader people who might be listening here. The challenge is, in some ways, some of the choices of this administration aren't typical left-wing, right-wing responses. And that makes it harder for my standard answer to just apply in a simple way. Meaning, if it's a normal Republican administration or a normal Democratic administration, then my general advice is rabbis should not engage in partisan policy proposals or in partisan choices. Our job is to highlight the values that the Torah commands and then to trust our people to apply those values in the politics or in the area of expertise. We're not policy makers. But what happens if you perceive a candidate or an office holder as having transcended normal areas of partisan debate and to be attempting to foist a level of behavior that isn't about left or right, it's just vulgar or immoral or gross. And I think, sadly, the challenge here is that there have been enough behavioral choices that have crossed that line. So, again, I would want us to try very hard to maintain as elevated a conversation as possible. But I'll go back to the example I gave, which was the Muslim ban and some of the rhetoric that has surrounded the debates about refugees and immigrants. One can have a difference of opinion about what kind of border security is reasonable. One can have a difference of opinion about how many people the United States should let in, or what's appropriate vetting to make sure that people who arrive here are themselves safe and that they don't create a danger for the people who are already here. Those are all areas where reasonable people might have different policy suggestions. But to castigate an entire faith because of the behavior of some people, that crosses a line, in my opinion, outside of politics. And so the question I guess I would want to reframe to answer is, do rabbis have an obligation to speak out against moral evil? And there I think the answer is yes, even if the person proposing the moral evil holds high office. I think it's the job of rabbis to oppose that. So let me give you a litmus test. If someone had proposed banning anyone from a Jewish community from coming into the United States, there wouldn't be a conversation within our community about whether we needed to have a strong public response of opposition. So I don't think if you switch out Jewish for Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, that should change the content of our response. So I think, again, I don't want to say, and I, you know, I'll, here's, okay, here, I will take it. I don't think that President Trump is himself a racist. But I do think he has, at the very least, allowed a rhetoric of racism to become public and for those people to feel safe. And so there are two options. Either that's deliberate on his administration's part, or it's an error. But in either way, it's not permissible. And I think it's our job on those kinds of areas where they've moved beyond debates of left-right policy into moral evil. I think that rabbis, along with all clergy and frankly all citizens, have an obligation to resist and to speak out against it. And if normalize means I'm not prepared to talk about that as if that's a thoughtful, civilized area of conversation, then no, we can't normalize it. But I don't know that that's what people mean. So if what people mean by that is we never accept any invitation to any meeting with the White House, no, I'm not in favor of that, because I do think we owe the institution of the White House and the institution of the presidency sufficient honor such that when there are candidates with whom we agree, that it can again be normalized. And I don't want to unleash a climate, I think we're already there, but I don't want to strengthen a climate in which if you don't agree with me, you're under harem. You're completely under the ban. I won't speak to you. I won't meet with you. I won't, like, for me, the tension is when he's functioning as President of the United States in his ceremonial, in Great Britain, government is divided in two ways. You have the effective functioning branch of the government led by the Prime Minister and Parliament, and then you have the ceremonial government led by royalty. I am not endorsing royalty. I am a Jeffersonian Democrat. I think it's a ridiculous and foolish custom. I say that with all due deference to my British colleagues and friends, all of them. But at least in Great Britain, it makes it clear which is which. In America, we've conflated both roles in the same individual. So the president is both the ceremonial representative of the United States government and also its chief policy proposer. And in that regard, I would want to make a distinction. So the president vis-a-vis intolerable policies and gross characterizations of vast segments of our population in the world, we should not and dare not normalize that kind of discourse. Our president, as ceremonial representative of American democracy, I would want to find ways to continue to honor the system and the office. I'm not sure how you do that, but that would be my goal.
If you receive, again, an invitation from the White House, what would you say to President Trump?
If I receive an invitation from the White House, and by that you mean an invitation to the Hanukkah party, honestly, I don't know what my reaction would be to that. I really don't know. I think I would sympathize with people who felt they needed to accept the invitation to honor the White House, and I think I would sympathize with people who said there have been so many statements and proposals that are off the charts, unacceptable, that they won't accept that invitation. I can tell you, without fear of contradiction, that if I got such an invitation and my mother found out, there would be hell to pay. Whether I accepted it or not, there'd be hell to pay.
Sorry, I didn't mean to tell what the thing is.
I was using my tilted finger. You're next.
How do you feel about Jews protesting on Shabbat? Is your answer any different for rabbinical students and rabbis than it is for Joe Jew public? And can you make your answer without invoking any heschel?
That's a great series of questions, and I especially love the last part. Yes, I can give you this answer without in any way quoting Abraham Joshua Heschel, Alav HaShalom. I would make a distinction between rabbinical students and rabbis and Stam Yidden, just plain old Jews. And the distinction would be in the following two areas. One is for conservative and Orthodox rabbinical students, and for Reform and Reconstruction students who feel committed to halakha as a system, I do think you need to consider that, both in terms of the realities involved and in terms of how it looks. So, were there a way to get to a protest without violating Shabbat? Then I'd want to think about how do we make it clear that this protest is not a suspension of Shabbat, it is the embodiment of Shabbat. That's caveat number one. And number two, because there's the appearances and then there's the content. I honestly think that the upswell of resistance is a commendable expression of American democracy. And for Jews who are not committed to the halachic process and whose politics leads them to protest, I think it is a reasonable thing to do on a Saturday or in a non-halachic Shabbos. But if you're committed to the mitzvah system as a system, then I guess I would want to invite us to do the harder task, which is although our hearts are drawn to be there, if there's no Shabbistic way to do that, what could we do instead? And to do the hard work of coming up with the reasonable alternative. I've never been good at letting other people set up dichotomies in which I have to pick two options, neither of which were mine. So if the world presents us with either you protest Trump on a Saturday or you're part of the problem, then I think entering into that choice is part of a bigger problem. Right? If we're really fighting for diversity and pluralism and multiculturalism, it can't be at the expense of my culture uniquely. So they could organize a protest on Sunday, and if they choose not to do that, that's a choice, but it doesn't dictate my choice. So I would want to find ways to align myself with the sentiment, but I would be very leery about violating Shabbat for it.
United States consulate in Jerusalem is on the same block as where Ziegler students study at the conservative yeshiva. It may theoretically be the case that should, and it's not clear that this will happen, should the embassy of the United States move to that building instead of being the consulate, there might be a great security risk, both in the general sense of uprisings or flares in tension, or on a localized level for that very block. If that should happen, and if there should be some sort of consequence for it, would you either consider canceling that year? Would you consider moving where that is? Or, at the very least, getting assurances of security from the Israeli government?
You know that I like putting my students at risk, particularly students who have a broken foot and jump off of ledges, who have indicated by that a gross disregard of the value of their own lives.
Well, at least limbs. Not necessarily life.
Yes, and seriously disregarding the law of gravity, which is a major violation. Although I can't help myself, and this is your fault, as Heschel said, you have to hit bottom before you see God. So I hope that when you landed with your broken foot, at least there was a theophany at the end.
I don't stop seeking God.
Good. So look, there are too many ifs in that hypothetical thing. What I can assure you is that if our students are at risk, we will find a way to make sure that they are reasonably secure. But I will also remind you that I'm very proud of the fact that the Ziegler School is the rabbinical school during both intifadas that refused to cancel its program, and whose students went. And I think that's a statement of our students' values and of our school's values, and we took steps to make sure that people were reasonably safe during such a time. But, you know, it might mean having to move, and frankly, that may be a terrible thing for every institution along that block, were it to happen. But so far, there's been no indications that I actually need to worry about that. And so with all deference, having enough actual things to worry about, I'm going to try to limit myself and not worry about the potential possibilities that might come. There will be time to worry about that later on. Others? Yeah.
During a protest last night, a bunch of rabbis were protesting the immigration ban.
Mm-hmm.
They were wearing talitot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my question is very specific, just about, we were talking earlier, some of us, about what to make of protesting while wearing a talit, especially when it's not relevant to the, like, it was at night, like, they were having a prayer vigil, but, like, it wasn't a service where you're required to wear one.
So I just want to point out the poetry that people get themselves arrested blocking traffic in front of Trump Tower, and what the Jewish community is focusing on arguing about is should they or should they not wear talitot. And while some people may decry that, I actually have a theory that explains it. I believe that Jewish survival has been because while other people debate reasonable things, we insist on finding obscure, picky little points to scream at each other about, right? So the Roman Empire is rising and falling, and we're having arguments about how can you make it possible to use an egg that was hatched on Shabbos in an immediate adjoining yuntif, right? And we're screaming at each other in the Beit Midrash as the Huns are invading the city and as the Goths are carrying people off. We are yelling at each other about these Beitzim, you know, and I think that's why we survive, because other people latch on to actual history and then they rise and they fall and you never hear from them again. But we're oblivious to it because we just keep having our own weird Jewish conversations as the rest of the world burns. So this may be a survival strategy, you know, as America plummets into its newest descent, we're going to be screaming at each other about the meaning of should you or should you not be wearing a talis, because of course it's at night, and was there really a minion, and can you count the Jewish police officer as part of the minion, and if you say something liturgical wearing a talis, are they forced to respond with a barhu after? We're like, we're going to be having that conversation, you know, while everyone else is talking about refugees and immigrants, and there's something beautiful and authentic about that. I also want to point out that the last time we had an argument about a talis was when a Christian minister gave one to candidate Trump, and that became a big subject of a Jewish debate. Should he have given him the talis? Should Trump have accepted the talis? Why was the talis colored the way it was? Shouldn't they have put blue in the, like, really, we had those conversations. So I do think it's a bit of an obsession of the Jewish people, some Jewish people. I do think it's actually silly. They wore the talis not to signify a halachic status for what they were doing. They did it because there isn't a public garment symbol of being Jewish, right? Yes, so some of them could have worn a kippah, but as we've already heard, it was nighttime. And so you wouldn't necessarily know if they're wearing a kippah. They wore it to look liturgical, in the same way that at some of the marches with Dr. King, you will see prominent rabbis walking with a Sefer Torah, right? It's not because they at any moment were going to like open it and start chanting. They did it because they wanted to make a statement that the Torah tradition is what impels us to be here. That's why they wore their tallis. So to the extent that the world could understand that tallis, not as a technical tallis, but rather like a clerical stole, indicating that what they see their actions as doing is being demanded by their religious tradition, that's, I think, the meaning of it. And I think there are bigger things for us to debate about the wisdom of what they did than whether or not they should wear a tallis. So I'd rather not get drawn into that the way I just did.
What the wisdom of what they did, though?
I have some questions that I would want to talk to them about. You know, one of which I will frame in the following way. Martin Luther King, when he was arrested for violating the very laws he was protesting. He didn't go find some extraneous reason to be arrested just so he could be arrested for a couple hours. And I don't know that it's an effective strategy to opt to do that. Like, no one would arrest them outside of Trump Tower, so they blocked traffic. But they didn't get arrested for Trump's policies. They got arrested for blocking traffic. And let me tell you, if I were driving home in Manhattan, I would want them arrested too, but they weren't arrested for Trump's policies. They were arrested for blocking traffic. And here's something I think about. I lived in San Francisco during the 60s, and there were large and often violent protests at San Francisco State. And the result of those protests was that Hayakawa got elected to the Senate. He was the president of San Francisco State. He organized the police response against the protesters, and he rode that into the Senate, where he was a fairly right-wing Republican senator for quite some time. So I worry that if we engage in what appear to people to be disjointed acts of clogging up the public life, rather than surgically precise protests that are intrinsically related to what we're protesting, I worry that we will make it easy for people to mischaracterize us and to be able to foster a counter response that will intensify the problem. And so I worry about that on a strategic level. I'm not sure what the long-term impact of such protests are going to be. And I worry about them.
What else, other than politics, Trump, Israel, is in your mind right now about what's happening and Judaism, and what else is happening in the world that we should be paying attention to and should be doing something about?
So, you know, the question is, other than Trump and politics, what else should we be focusing on? And I think the question itself reflects a sense that things are not normal and that there is a different level of focus and a different level of fear than has been true in the past. Some of us think that's appropriate. Some of us may not. I do think that's not going to go away. The administration keeps making idiosyncratic choices that are going to create strong responses across the board. And I guess what I want to invite all of us to do is to remember that at the same time that we're fighting for the politics we care about, left or right, that we also need to fight for the kind of civil community that we all can be humans in, and that we also need to remember that the rest of life goes on. So, what are we offering to people whose souls are wounded? And they're wounded because of, I don't know, relationship challenges, life cycle challenges, depression, sorrow. How are we helping people rejoice at moments of joy in their own lives or their families? How are we helping people to get through difficult transition times? You know, the ongoing work of Judaism isn't just in the realm of social justice, although that's a big piece of it, and we can't ignore that. But we are more than that. So if we're not attending to people's souls and to caring for broken hearts, then I think, in a sense, we've undermined our own authenticity. And so I would want us as a community to redouble the ways we care for each other, and the way we hold each other, and the way we're present for each other. And then the other piece is, at the core, our tradition, I think, and I've said this a lot, is a wisdom tradition. So are we helping people gain access to the wisdom in the Torah tradition, not just mobilizing it for political opinions? Right? And again, I'm not in any way delegitimizing mobilize. Judaism has a lot to say about social justice, and that is an appropriate part of our concern. But if it blots out the rest of what we're needing to do in the world, then I think we weaken ourselves, you know, and we do that on a human level. Right? So I know that I and a lot of people have been feeling pretty battered of late. We need to take care of each other better. We need to hold each other and lift each other up. We need to give each other a Torah of inspiration and a Torah of consolation. Are we letting people know that the Ribono Shel Olam has not abandoned them? Are we letting them know that when they walk through the Valley of the Shadows, they're not alone, and that our tradition offers them consolation and succor and uplift? I think that's got to be an explicit focus of our ongoing work. And to some degree, the politics both distracts from that sometimes, and its obsessive nature distracts from that. Who knew that I would one day miss a Facebook of kittens and puppies? But here I be. I know. But they're cute. They're really cute.
How should one, in general, decide how much money to donate to causes that are important to them? And I guess I'm asking particularly as a student to offer instead of
that
right now.
How do you make decisions about how much money to donate, particularly if you're in a constrained financial reality? So I have some good news that comes sounding like bad news. When you're no longer a student and you have a paying job, you'll still have enormous financial constraints. So I think that's good news, but I'm not sure. I think our tradition counsels us to give what we can give without being irresponsible. You're not allowed to put yourself in jeopardy. You're not allowed to put your future in jeopardy. You're not allowed to put your capacity to care for your responsibilities and your loved ones in jeopardy. So if you're giving at that level, then you're not doing a mitzvah anymore. On the other hand, if you're not giving to a point that your gift feels real, like my life would be absolutely identical whether I gave this amount or not, then you're probably not giving enough. That certainly applies, by the way, to charitable contributions to the rabbinical school you're attending. But it applies to other charities, too. So, you know, I think part of the way we do good in the world is we turn occasions into moments to give. But not if you're endangering your own security or the security of your loved ones, then that's too much. And the other thing is to take a long-term view. You'll be, God willing, earning money for a long time, and there are multiple ways you'll be able to give. There are still multiple ways you can give. So maybe it means you think of non-financial ways to contribute, and ways that you can support others who are contributing in other ways, and know that those causes will be around for a long, long time. My mother marched in the march in San Francisco the Saturday after the elections, and she's been marching since the Vietnam War, and she said her favorite sign was someone her age marching with a sign saying, "I can't believe I'm still marching about this stuff." You know, it'll be there.
I know that the differences often between the practical use of halal and kosher and kashrut are that kashrut has certain more stringencies on like which cuts of the meat and the restriction about mixing meat with milk. But would it be halakhically possible if it were the case that, say, a halal certifying agency were to work with a kashrut teudah, if they went with the stringencies of kashrut, or if there are stringencies in halal, for them to work together and have a joint supervising agency?
Do you ever ask non-hypothetical questions, just hypothetically?
The future is all hypothetical. So
indeed it is. look, what I think is clear is when we can cooperate with others, it's nice to do. So if someday down the road a rabbinic body and a halal body could agree to jointly acceptable standards that did not violate the standards of either tradition, and they issued a joint certification, I think that would be great. But that means it would have to meet all of the requirements of kashrut and meet all of the requirements of halal. It couldn't be compromising. All right, everybody. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.